From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden and Speaker Kevin McCarthy make a deal to raise the debt limit with concessions to House Republicans on federal spending and work requirements in aid programs. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial board member Kate Batchelder-Odell. Let's start with two Republicans. First, Kevin McCarthy at a press conference on Sunday explaining his view of this deal.
Just to take you back to where we all started, back to February 1st, sat down with the president. I said, let's work together to be able to raise the debt ceiling, but curve the amount of spending. To let America be able to work again, cut red tape, get some work requirements to help people get back into work. I think this agreement frames all that from limit, save, grow. It doesn't get everything everybody wanted, but that's in divided government. That's where we end up. I think it's a very positive bill.
And here's a clip from Congressman Patrick McHenry talking about another aspect of this agreement.
We have consequential work requirements on important programs. We eliminate loopholes, and we bring in the value of work to these important programs. The meaning and value of work connected with fiscal responsibility, those are very important top lines for this negotiations. But it wouldn't have been possible without the firm commitment of House Republicans and us passing a plan.
Kim, can you start by giving us an overview of what is in this agreement?
Sure. And I'll just say up front, too, that I think this is a victory for McCarthy and his team. This was a negotiation over a debt limit that needed to be raised one way or another. It had to be done. And yet the GOP came together to a united front and forced Biden to sit down and negotiate something in return for raising that debt ceiling. So it isn't everything, but Republicans did get something solid in all four areas that they went into asking. So one of them was reductions in spending over the next 2 years. The non-defense discretionary spending will be capped at $704 billion for fiscal 2024. That's not as low as Republicans had wanted to go, but it's a big cut from where spending was projected to go. That was $757 billion. There will be a 1% increase for fiscal 2025, which is a significant departure from the 8, 9, 10% increases in non-defense discretionary spending we'd seen in recent years. In a second category, they got some modest work requirements, not what Republicans wanted. The big dollar savings were in Medicaid. These are instead for the SNAP program and the temporary assistance for needy families. Again, quite modest, but I think it was notable that Democrats had claimed these programs were inviolable, that you could not impose any work requirements. So they did get something. They are clawing back COVID funds. They are clawing back some IRS funds. And then finally, there's a section of the bill that deals with permitting reform for federal projects. Notably, this is the first statutory reforms to the National Environmental Policy Act since 1982. We could go through what that is. I think that it's a good step to trying to cut down on some of the excessive periods of time it takes to get any infrastructure done. There's still a lot more that needs to be done, but that's probably going to have to wait for Congress. So they went in. They set out a very high bar of demands in terms of what they'd put in their Limit, Save, Grow Act. Didn't get it all, but they accomplished some real priorities. And I think they're going to end up getting a significant amount of support for Republicans and even some Democrats to get this across the line.
To underline some of those overall non-defense discretionary figures, House Republicans had wanted a return to fiscal 2022 levels for fiscal 2024. So that would have been $689 billion. The projected 2024 was $757 billion, and this agreement is for $704. So meeting in the middle, that's what happens when you have divided government, a Republican House, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic president. And then there's a cap of the increase for fiscal 2025 of 1%. And remember, we are in an environment of right now inflation at 5 or 6%, and who knows what that will be in 2025. But I can't believe it will be under 1%. And so that is a decrease, a shrinking of at least this portion of the federal government relative to the overall economy and the overall spending power of that money. Kate, can you give us a sense of what's your view of how significant these work requirements are? Again, the Republicans wanted more than are in this actual bill, but there are some in this bill, which strikes me as significant.
Kylie, yes, it is significant in short. And I think stepping back for a quick second, to Kim's point, when you look back over some of the recent showdowns over debt ceiling fights and other runs at spending reforms that Republicans have made, this is a huge improvement in that the party singled out some specific asks, stuck to them, and extracted some concessions in exchange for raising the debt ceiling, and looks like poised to pass it. I mean, this is a huge improvement from where the GOP has been in recent years, where they want to get everything and then end up with nothing. On the narrow part of work requirements, the Republicans did not get anything on Medicaid, but I think that was always understood to be a really heavy lift as a health entitlement program. And even conservatives are somewhat split on how to enforce Medicaid work requirements, given people go to the emergency room and need care and so on. So that was always a larger ideological ask that was probably off the table here. What's remarkable is that they got most of what else that they asked for. On food stamps, we have an increase in the age band for able-bodied adults who don't have children at home. They now, up to age 54, will need to work part-time if they want to have benefits for longer than 3 months. So that is a modest expansion. It's reasonable. Now, even since 1996, there's been an improvement in the amount of number of jobs you can do up until age 54 that are not physically demanding, for instance. So that is an improvement. They also, Kyle, did a number of things in this bill just to crack down on ways that states have tried to evade these work requirements that exist in the statute. If states were half as creative about getting people back into work as they are into trying to get out of these work requirements, this bill probably wouldn't be necessary. But just a quick example of those, in cash assistance, temporary assistance for needy families, a few states were doing this thing where they are supposed to engage half of their families in work. And to satisfy that requirement, they would find people who are on other federal benefits, maybe they're getting food stamps, and who are already working, and then mail them a $10 to $20 check and then say, oh, you're on this cash assistance program now and you're working, so we'll count you towards our requirement. I mean, these are the kind of basic schemes that House Republicans are trying to end. And that's why I think it's so impressive that Democrats are acting like even this is an anathema. But this is real progress on getting back towards the foundation of these benefit programs that pair work with receiving benefits. So I think it's a substantial improvement, and the farm bill is coming in the fall and Republicans can take it back up then and try to get more of their priorities.
There's also an incentive in the bill for Congress to do its job of passing appropriations legislation in its normal order. Kim, what's the importance of that, and how likely is it, given how many people in Congress love the old omnibus where they can stuff everything in at the end of the year?
And that's the context for this enforcement mechanism, is that you may remember when Republicans took over the House and they were coming up with their rules and electing a speaker, this was a big topic of conversation, regular order. Under budget law, Congress is supposed to, the House is supposed to, and the Senate is separately supposed to pass 12 separate appropriations bills. The committees for those two chambers then come into conference and negotiate an agreement. Those bills go to the president's desk. That has not happened in ages. I think that over the past 25 years, it's only happened on maybe three occasions. I'd have to check that, but it's very low. They almost always fail to do it. And instead, what you get is Congress not getting through its work by the fiscal deadline in September, passing a continuing resolution to keep spending where it is, passing another one, finally getting to the end of the year and stuffing all of its spending into these 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 page bills with policy stuffed in as well, all kinds of things. Nobody reads it. They all vote for it and everyone goes home. And that has been a cause of an enormous amount of spending, but also poor policy in that it's not really debated and considered, but just stuffed in a back room and over the line. So this is designed to fix that. And the penalty here is that if either the House or the Senate has not completed all 12 of those bills by the end of the calendar year. They are giving people a little bit more time instead of the regular September deadline. Then all spending in discretionary accounts takes a 1% cut off of the prior year's levels. So that is meant to be a cudgel. It does apply to both domestic discretionary spending and defense spending, which is a little concerning to me only because I would not like to see the military hampered if for some reason Senate Democrats don't get their work done. But that was the compromise that was in there, in that the White House didn't want House Republicans to take domestic discretionary hostage, and the Republicans didn't want the White House and Senate Democrats to take the military hostage. So they kind of have a little tool on each side. But this could be, if this works, and I think that it will be a pretty good prod to get it done. This could be the first time in a very long time we'll have regular budget order.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Kate, what about the Pentagon's end of this? So far in this program, we've been talking mostly about non-defense spending. This agreement between the president and Speaker McCarthy boosts defense spending by about 3% in fiscal 2024, and that is also below the rate of inflation that we're seeing. And then what about these mandatory cuts if Congress doesn't pass a budget in the regular order?
Yeah, Kyle. So I think Kim is right that, first of all, it's an improvement that Republicans kind of broke the logjam known as parity, where every dollar that goes into domestic accounts is paired with one for the Pentagon. I don't think that's, after, you know, years of COVID emergency spending, appropriate. I do think this increase for the Pentagon here is basically, what it does is basically accepts Joe Biden's budget proposal. Now, in the past couple of years, Joe Biden has been sending over a Pentagon proposal to Congress that represents a real cut and doesn't keep up with inflation. And what happens is Congress adds significant amounts of money to it and has made it, you know, a modest, maybe a 1% real increase, depending on how you calculate it. And this year, we are going to have what doesn't amount to real growth in the Pentagon budget. Now, I think that is a potential risk. And I think Republicans should be out there even now saying, look, this deal is worth it because we have some other priorities here that we get, but we're not currently taking our self-defense seriously. Defense analysts talk, Kyle, a lot about something called the Davidson window, and it's named after a former Navy admiral who sketched out a period of danger in the 2020s over a fight, for instance, for Taiwan, where after the 2020s, China has some demographic problems, the US military gets some new equipment that makes them more powerful, that we're potentially in a vulnerable decade right now, and the need for military power is more acute now than it will be several years from now. Maybe that doesn't end up to be the case, but that does make this budget a little more risky. So I think Republicans will have to make a larger issue of this at some point. Meanwhile, they will have to play this hand the absolute best that they can in the appropriations process. And that might mean an aggressive reform effort, including shutting down the Pentagon grocery stores and other things that have been politically difficult to do. And last point is on those caps that you mentioned, automatic cuts if 12 appropriations bills aren't passed. I think the Pentagon is probably at a unique risk there because the Democrats could decide to take it a hostage and they won't mind if it gets hit with an indiscriminate cut. That said, Congress does need to get back to regular order, and hopefully this will be an incentive to do so. In the Budget Control Act of 2011, these caps were supposed to be so draconian that they would never hit, and that didn't work out. So I do have some concerns that these caps could hold a sword over the Pentagon, but there's also an opening to do Congress's job, and that would be really good to get back to regular order for spending priorities across the board.
Kim, a couple of odds and ends. You made note of some changes to environmental reviews for projects that are subject to federal reviews or require federal permits. How would that provision be enforced? Because the Trump administration, for example, put some limits on how long those environmental reviews were supposed to go on. But the criticism that I hear from people up on Capitol Hill is they're essentially toothless. And then number two, there's also a provision in this deal related to President Biden's desire to beef up the IRS. I wonder if you could explain what's going on there.
Sure. On the permitting front, here's the thing that I think matters. First of all, what the Republicans managed to get from this deal was to actually include some new language in the National Environmental Policy Act. This would be the first time since 1982 that there had been a statutory change to that rule. That rule is the thing that often is in the way of any of these infrastructure projects. Sometimes reviews, environmental reviews that are done under NEPA can last 7, 8, 9 years. The Trump administration attempted to fix this with a regulatory change. And those changes, for instance, set a higher bar for what projects were subject to NEPA review, codified that there would be one lead agency on environmental reviews rather than multiple and overlapping ones, included a 1-year deadline for environmental assessments and a 2-year deadline for full environmental impact statements. Those were regulations. And the problem, of course, with regulations is that they can be repealed. And indeed, immediately upon taking office, Biden repealed them. So what this is doing is retaking most of those, putting them into statute, so a future Democratic president cannot necessarily just banish them. And there is your point about the toothlessness. One thing this does include is that if the federal government fails to hit these deadlines or to comply by these new NEPA rules, that the project manager, those that are doing the infrastructure project, can sue and get a court to try to enforce the deadlines and enforce the rules. Now, litigation is expensive. Yes. Is there better ways to do this? There definitely are. Is there far more that needs to be done on permitting? Absolutely. But there is still a great desire by Democrats to get some reform so that they can more easily do their renewable transmission build out. And Republicans in the Senate and the House intend to use that as leverage to get some even greater NEPA reform. So there's still work for Congress to do. On the IRS, you've seen a lot of Republicans complaining about this. They wanted all $80 billion of that money from last year that went to the IRS to be repealed. That did not happen. Instead, what we know for certain is that the bill cuts $1.4 billion, but it's the money that was earmarked for this year for the IRS to increase its enforcement, which means that their plan to turbocharge their enforcement divisions are currently on hold. Republicans intend to go back and try to get some more. And then also, interestingly, there's already talk among Democrats who are bitter about the money that they are losing in discretionary accounts. They are talking about potentially robbing that IRS fund to try to beef up some of their own programs domestically.
So what about the politics here? Because the IRS piece is not the only thing that some conservatives are complaining about. Here is Congressman Ralph Norman on Twitter. This deal is insanity. A $4 trillion debt ceiling increase with virtually no cuts is not what we agreed to. Not going to vote to bankrupt our country. The American people deserve better. Rand Paul, also on Twitter, says, no real cuts to see here. Conservatives have been sold out once again. And Kate, I guess my reaction is that when this whole process started, as Speaker McCarthy said at the top, President Biden was insisting on a clean debt ceiling increase with nothing in it, saying he would not even negotiate. He refused for a while to even sit down with Speaker McCarthy. And now we have a debt ceiling deal that raises the debt ceiling, as Kim said, it's something that was going to have to be done anyway. And there was probably a majority in the House and in the Senate to do that in a clean way if we got down to hours until the United States defaults. And so instead of that, we now have a deal with spending restraint under inflation, and we have a deal with work requirements. We have a deal with some NEPA reforms. We have a deal with robbing the IRS of funding that Democrats have been giving it. And so honestly, it's more than I expected when this whole process began, and very different, I think, than the kamikaze missions that Republicans have gone on before in these kinds of things, trying to defund Obamacare, if people remember that whole saga. But it does raise the prospect that Speaker McCarthy will need significant numbers, maybe, of Democratic votes to get that across. And President Biden is not exactly running a whip count for it right now. Here he is speaking Monday on the White House.
I feel very good about it. I've spoken to a number of the members. I spoke to McConnell. I spoke to a whole bunch of people. And it feels good. We'll see when the vote starts. And look, one of the things that I hear some of you guys saying is, why didn't Biden say what a good deal it is? Why would Biden be saying what a good deal is before the vote? You think that's going to help me get it passed? No.
And Kate, there is some tension there. If you're going to pass this with some Democratic votes, the more that President Biden is out there proclaiming it a great deal, the more likely it is that some of these dissenting Republicans can pick off a few of their colleagues.
Yeah. And Kyle, I'm really not sure, you know, when we talk about this being a bad deal, we do have to consider relative to what. And to your point, the president was saying for months that he wasn't going to negotiate at all, that they were going to get nothing, and that he was going to ride this all the way up to the brink and then roll them. And for those of us who have followed this, that was a possibility that it could happen, given the way that it would be spun, the demands of the fear of default. So this is a big achievement compared with that alternative. Now, I understand that this deal doesn't change the fundamental spending trajectory of this country, which would, to do that, you will need to deal with entitlements, which were off the table to begin with. So if you can't touch entitlements, and if the defense budget has a real need, you're really down to a sliver of the federal budget in discretionary spending. So this is not a deal that is going to change that, but the alternative was raising the debt ceiling and getting nothing for it. So I think it's a big improvement over that. I'd also add one more thing, which is just that this is an opportunity to show that Republicans have the ability to hang together on their demands and pass something. Failure breeds more failure, and success, even modest success, even getting only some of the reforms that you want, tends to lead to more success. So for instance, I think this puts Republicans in a stronger position to continue to build on work requirements as part of the farm bill this year, to continue to press the case to the public that people who receive food stamps should work part-time in exchange for them if they are able-bodied and don't have kids at home, or maybe if their kids are in school. That's a popular political position. But if Republicans were to descend into dysfunction now and fail to pass this, they can forget about having that leverage in a farm bill, let alone to say anything about maybe extending work requirements into programs like Medicaid, which Democrats view as untouchable as a healthcare entitlement. So I understand it can be disappointing to not get everything you want in a deal. But I do think you layer this on brick by brick and you bank this progress now and you try to use some of that momentum to build on it later in the year.
Kim, we'll give you the last word. Any thoughts on the politics here? And to the point about success building on success, it's remarkable now to think back. Kevin McCarthy seems that he's beating expectations here, racking up some political capital, which may help him later when he needs some of those Republicans who are skeptical to take tougher votes, that he's led them to what looks like a victory here in this debt ceiling fight, if indeed it passes.
Well, just to give our listeners some perspective, which you don't always get from the press, because the press has a stated interest in turning this into drama and theater and the, you know, default is coming and will McCarthy be able to get his members on and there's a White House revolt by progressives. Look, the reality is that barring one caveat, which I will lay out in a minute, this is likely to pass with significant votes in the House. For all you are hearing from some very vocal people on the right. These are people like Ralph Norman, Chip Roy, saying that this is an absolutely terrible bill and that McCarthy didn't get anything that he was supposed to get. I did a count and I have come up with about 9 people who have so far said that they will absolutely be a no. Now, those numbers are likely to grow. Scott Perry, who heads the Freedom Caucus, came out and had a press conference today voicing his misgivings. So there will be more members of the Freedom Caucus that will vote against this. But McCarthy is likely to retain a significant number of his members. And meanwhile, the leadership of the New Democrat Coalition, which is a more left-center leading caucus within the House, made up of about 100 Democrats, their leadership came out today and said that they would support it. Now, they may not get all 100, but again, you start to add these numbers up, you need 218. Now, the issue is procedural. This has got to go through the Rules Committee in the House. Republicans have a 9-4 majority on that committee. But three of those people in the Republican majority are people who have said that they will not support the bill. Now, if you do the math, that already is not enough to get it over the line. However, one of those, Tom Massey, who's a Kentucky Republican, he was on record months ago back during the speaker's fight saying that he never intended to use his position on the Rules Committee to single-handedly block the will of the majority. So based on that, there's some assumption that he will in fact allow this to simply move out of committee and then it can be dealt with on the floor. I can't agree with you more. I think McCarthy has really defied expectations here, not just by passing the bill in the first place, but by getting this deal with the president. And that's why you don't hear any talk. I would just point this out. Of anybody suggesting that they're going to call for a motion to vacate the chair and revolt against him. He did a really great job of bringing in all corners of his caucus when they were putting together that bill to make everyone feel as though they were being heard. And they appreciate that. So I think it's a very good sign that while you see Republicans very forcefully speaking out against this bill, that nobody is suggesting that they're going to go all hostage level and try to take out McCarthy if they, as a single member, don't get what they want.
Thank you, Kim and Kate. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.